the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Here's your host, Jim Poplava.
Many of today's workers will lack the resources to retire at traditional ages and maintain their standard of living throughout their retirement years. Solving the problem is becoming a major challenge in today's environment, which risk and responsibility have shifted from government employers to you, the individual. And how do we combat this crisis? That's the subject of today's interview. And my guest, Alicia Monell. She's written a book, along with other authors, called Falling Short, The Coming Retirement Crisis, and What to Do About It. Alicia, I want to talk about the way things were almost 40 years ago, at least when I got into the business and was doing financial planning. You know, retirees at that time had it pretty good. They had pensions, they had Social Security, and they pretty much lived a worry-free life. What happened to that golden age?
A couple of things happened to the golden age. Most prominently, we have a shift from the old-fashioned pension plan where you got an income for life to 401ks, which are working fine for a minority of the population, but not well for others. The other is we had solid replacement rates from Social Security, and those are going down because the full retirement age is going from 65 to 67, which means that the benefits you claim before the higher retirement age are actuarially reduced and lower than they were 40 years ago. So the individual is, and the household are in a much more dilemma in terms of supporting themselves once they stop working.
Yeah, because if you take a look at, not only are we seeing an economic and demographic shift in this country, I think, 10,000 boomers retiring daily, but as you just pointed out, Social Security covers less of your income. Employers have shifted the burden of providing for retirement to the individual with 401k plans. And also another issue that has cropped up is employers are covering less of healthcare costs, including while you're working, not to mention very few people get healthcare costs when they retire.
That's absolutely right. So that the two other things that you're talking about are rapidly rising healthcare costs, the prospect of very expensive long-term care at the end of life, and then the fact that we're all living longer. So whatever amount of money we have in our pile, we have to use that over a longer period of time.
You know, something that kind of strikes me, when I got in the business in the early 80s, you know, the expected lifespan for men were anywhere from 65 to 68 years of age. Alicia, I have clients who are in their 90s now. I mean, people weren't expected to live this long when Social Security and pension systems were first put into place.
So I generally look at it, what was life expectancy at age 65, because there was a lot of sort of infant mortality and people dying very early. And basically that was 12 years when the program started. And now the typical person is who's 65 can expect to live almost 20 more years. And that's the average. And higher income people with more education are way on the high side of that. So to have an additional 30 years that you need to support yourself after you stop working is not going to be that unusual.
So, you know, as we look at this, where does this leave the individual? You talk about in your book, you've got three possible options. One is just to accept, you know, your lifestyle and retirement isn't going to be what it was when you were working. A second option is maybe cut back dramatically on, let's say, your current expenditures and save more. And number three is work longer. And possibly, Alicia, there it's going to end up being a combination of several of those.
Well, I think any rational person in this looking at this predicament would want some combination of the three. Yes, save a little bit more while you're working. If you're maybe you want to accept a little bit less in retirement, but I'm a big fan of working longer as the most potent lever that people have some control over.
You know, Alicia, we've interviewed a lot of experts, including Dr. Gary Small from UCLA's Longevity Center, and he said there is a direct link to staying active, actively engaged in working in retirement in terms of longevity. So the longer you work, you're more actively engaged. That does a number of things we ought to talk about, because it not only enables you to, let's say, postpone receiving Social Security, So when you do at age 70, you'll have larger benefit, but also allows you to, let's say, accumulate over a longer period of time, which makes your retirement more secure.
That's absolutely right. I mean, there's always been a correlation between work and health, but it's never been exactly clear which way the causation was. Do healthy people just work longer, or are people who work longer made more healthy? And I think that experiments, particularly in the Nordic countries, and we did one here with data from the Netherlands, show that there's a direct causation between working longer and health and the likelihood of dying after you retire. So working longer is good for you. It provides structure. You know, you have colleagues and you feel that you've accomplished something during the day. So it has multiple benefits. Of course, we who sit here and our main job is to write paragraphs have to say all that with some understanding that people have jobs that are not fun, not interesting, that are physically demanding. And so it's not the right thing for everyone, but for a lot of the people, it is totally possible to work till 70. And as you said, get a Social Security monthly benefit that's 76% higher than it would be if you claimed at 62.
You know, Alicia, what about another option? And that is, let's say you retire, and maybe you were in one of those jobs you didn't really like. It wasn't a lot of fun. Maybe it was stressful. But you actually work part-time and actually do something different, something that you enjoy. I had a client who ended up becoming a tour guide at Hearst Castle and just absolutely loved it. It was a part-time employment, but it supplemented his income. It allowed him to defer receiving Social Security until age 70, so he got a larger check, but he absolutely loved part-time work, and he did it well into his 70s.
And I think that is a very logical alternative. We've done a lot of work on what makes people retire earlier than they expected. And part of that work showed that people who shifted to other jobs in their 50s and found sort of a good fix actually retired later than they expected to. So people usually get jobs like your client that pay less, but that have some interesting component, less stress, and you're willing to do it for longer than you would have done your main job.
You know, one thing that I think is a tragedy, and we talked about how 401k programs have put the onus of retirement onto the employee. But, you know, the one thing that I was really surprised, and I've seen it study after study, Alicia, is that the number of individuals that don't take advantage of it, because number one, you get a tax deduction for doing it, so you save taxes. Number two, in many cases, employers will match your funds to some extent, not maybe 100%, although some do. So, but, you know, let's say a 50% match. So, I mean, you put a dollar in and you've automatically made 50% your first year. Why do you think more people aren't taking advantage of this?
So I think the numbers have come down, but you're absolutely right. There's still about 20% of people who could participate in a plan who don't. And that they're usually younger, lower income people, lower paid people, but they are forfeiting a lot. As you know, the compound interest is a powerful force. And to put it in, get that match, and let it grow would put them in a much better position going forward.
You know, how did we ever get to the point? I mean, your book is talking about the coming retirement crisis. I don't think a lot of people are, when you think of a crisis, you think of the financial crisis, you think of a debt crisis, you think of things going on in Europe. We're not thinking about what's going on in our own country.
So it's slow moving. And I think, you know, as you well know, the first cohorts of people covered primarily by 401k plans are just retiring now. And so we really haven't seen evidence that how they fare once they stop working. And I think it's going to become increasingly evident that they cannot maintain their standard of living, which means different things for people at different spots in the income distribution. But for everyone, it's going to be at least disappointing, if not involve serious hardship.
And you know, the other thing I think most people aren't thinking about, even if they're retiring at age 65, they're not thinking, Alicia, of living to age 90. I have one client, she's a female. I think she's going to turn 102 this year. She is in a retirement home. I have many, many clients in their 90s. So with this advancement in medical technology, and we're learning more about you know, either better drugs, better treatments, better diets, exercise, you know, plain and simple, we're living longer.
So we did a little exercise that just supports your point that we were trying to figure out what would be the appropriate retirement age today if 65 were the right age in 1940. And the age that keeps the ratio of retirement years to work years constant, so you sort of spread the extra years between the two, is 70. So I'm all in favor of somebody using their bully pulpit to announce that 70 is the nation's retirement age. We used to have a national retirement age. Everybody would talk about 65. It was the age you got your full Social Security benefits. It's the age you got private pension benefits. It's the age that you got Medicare. It was the commonly accepted age. Now we have this sort of slew of ages that people throw around. And I think we need to announce that the age 70 is the one that people should aim for. It's the age at which you get your highest Social Security benefit. It's the age at which, if you can delay claiming and keep working to that age, you probably will be fine in retirement.
Yeah, because one of the things you highlight in your book is declining replacement rates, which is a result of three reasons. The phasing in of already legislated benefit cuts. We're seeing increases in Medicare premiums and also the taxation of Social Security benefits. So all of these have had impact in one way or another on retirement.
That's absolutely correct. And one other factor that I don't always put on the list is that we now have two earner couples. In the old days under Social Security, the husband got a full benefit, 100%, and then the wife who didn't work got 50%. Now each one is earning his or her own benefit, and that brings down the household replacement rate. So what we're getting from Social Security is just not as much as families did 40 years ago.
I want to talk about something you address in your book. It's, you know, you don't hear too many politicians talking about it, but that is fixing Social Security, because the Social Security Administration says by 2033, unless something is done to correct it, they, you know, benefits could be cut as much as 25%. What do we do? It seems like maybe pushing back the retirement age would be one solution. How do we fix this?
So I'm glad you put it absolutely correctly. A lot of times in the press, when the trust fund goes is depleted, which happens in 2030, that people treat that as if the Social Security program were bankrupt. It's not. It still has benefits to, enough income coming in to cover 75% of benefits. And so the decision we have to make as a nation is, so we have this gap between current revenues and promised benefits. And how do we want to solve the problem? Do we want to maintain promised benefits and put in more revenues, or maintain current taxes and cut benefits? And so that's really a national decision. There's been some legislation introduced in the last week with 200 co-signers in the House that would essentially put more money into the system and maintain and enhance benefits that are currently provided. And so that is important to get that option on the table. And people, we can do this. It's just, it is a big decision, and it should reflect the preference of the Americans.
So basically, when you boil it down to, what can an individual do? We talked about they can work longer, they can save more, and perhaps even invest wiser, you know, than they have. Because one of the things that really surprises me is how little people watch. We see this all the time with 401k plans. You know, let's say you were fortunate enough, you sign up for one at work, but you sort of put it on automatic pilot, which may not be a wise thing to do if you're only a couple of years away from retirement, or periodically checking to make sure you're in the right allocation given your age bracket.
I think we've made this a lot easier in that a lot of companies have automatic enrollment, so they put you in the plan, and then there's a default investment, which is often a target date. The thing which has some mixture of stocks and bonds, and then moves more towards bonds or fixed income as you age. I think the concern should be, on Jack Bogle's honor, to make sure that fees are low, and that you're in one that sort of, and that makes you comfortable, because there are a lot of glide paths there.
When you're taking a look at these options, I want to move on to something that can be either a major problem, and that is what I call the drawdown rate, or drawing down your assets. A lot of, you know, a very popular figure used in the planning industry is the 4% rule. If you have, you know, $1 million, you take 4% a year, and that'll last you 25 years. What could go wrong with that type of approach?
That the market can fluctuate a lot. And also, as you pointed out, there's a pretty good chance of, for especially if higher education, more highly educated people living more than 25 years. And because unfortunately, or fortunately, fortunately for those with education, that's a good thing, but they've seen the major gains in life expectancy. And so when you look at averages, that doesn't tell you a lot about the people who have 401ks. So they could live a much longer time. And there's no, I mean, the theoretical way to make this all work out is to buy an annuity of some sort, but people really don't like to buy annuities. So it's figuring out some kind of drawdown mechanism. We've had almost no evidence of how people behave when they retire with 401ks, because these are the first group that are primarily dependent on it. But I think the drawdown issue is huge and requires a lot of thought.
Why is it, in your opinion, that back in the days when we had defined benefit pension plans, I don't know if people realized what they really had was an annuity, but the company you worked for had a pot of money. They went to an insurance company and they said, you know, based on this gentleman's life and his wife, you know, what would you give him depending on what his annuity option was? Why do you think annuities have such a bad rap? Because they used to be a very staple part of retirement, and especially when you look at defined benefit pension plans, which were essentially annuities.
So I think when we get annuities naturally, we're happy, right? Nobody fights Social Security and wants a lump sum. And as you said, people love DB plans. They had this regular check that entitled them to spend. They said, this money is for spending in the next month. And so when it happens automatically, we're happy. If somebody comes to us and says, could you please give us $100,000 and we'll pay you out a benefit for life, that just doesn't seem as appealing. People love their piles. They tend to undervalue flows, and they're just not comfortable doing it. Also, I mean, there's some real issues that a lot of the annuities are priced for people who are going to live a very long time and may be too expensive for the average guy. But there's a visceral reaction, negative reaction to them.
Yeah, because we have a client right now who just at age 88 moved into a retirement home. But when we were doing his financial plan, when it came time to either take the money in a lump sum or get an annuity, we analyzed it, and that was back when rates were much higher. But the best option for him, and it turned out to play very well into his retirement, he took the annuity option, and boy, is he glad he ever did that.
Yeah, especially with the decline in rates. I mean, there's also these deferred life annuities, so that you buy something at 65 that'll kick in at 85, so that you know for sure if you live beyond the expected 20 years that you will have some sort of income. And then it allows you also to feel more comfortable about spending the money you have during that 20-year period. I'm very concerned that people are going to undertap their 401k balances, that they're going to be too cautious. They're really going to deny themselves things that they should have because they're fearful that they're going to run out of money. They're fearful they're going to have large end-of-life expenses, and they will not spend what they should.
You talk about fixing 401k plans and making them better, more appealing, and make them work better in terms of providing for retirement. I wonder if you would just go over some of the options you propose and how that would impact a lot of our listeners who are putting money in 401k plans.
So, yes, that is actually part of a multi-stage proposal of what needs to be done. But certainly we have 401k plans. At least half the today's workers have 401k plans, and they should be made to work as well as they possibly can. And I think that can be done by saying if you have a 401k plan, it has to have automatic enrollment. It has to have automatic escalation in the default contribution rate. So if they start you at 3%, that has to go up slowly to 10%. It should probably have within the plan some way of withdrawing at least some of it in terms of lifetime income. So people have some security that they will always have some income. And so, and then the fees should be monitored carefully. And basically that would mean that people in these plans would be getting as good a benefit from them as they possibly can. The other thing is, I just have to emphasize it, is that if you take a snapshot of private sector workers in the United States, only half are working with for an employer that provides a plan. So we have a huge coverage gap. And the work we're doing now suggests that a lot of people move from places that have a plan to places that don't. So simple calculations that you do, you know, say if you do this every year and you earn an average return, you should have this huge pile. People don't end up with that huge pile because they're not contributing every year.
You know, as you take a look at this, the thing I loved about your book, you get straight to the point. It's not filled with a lot of jargon. A lot of people wouldn't understand. It's short and it's highly readable. What kind of attention have you gotten? Anybody in Washington or any politician picking up on what you're writing about?
So people talk, not politicians so much. I think the best way to get stuff done is to talk to the staff of people in the House and in the Senate. And we do talk to them, and there are bills going through that will help a bit. But we really do need something to, you know, have a big fix on 401ks, to have a big fix on covering the uncovered. And you really need to have something that covers people automatically, because if you leave it up to them, they're just not going to join. And so we have to use that bad word, mandate. We really need to mandate that employers that don't provide a plan put their employees' money in an IRA or some kind of account. Doesn't have any burden on the employer other than just making sure that payroll deduction is up and running.
Alicia, you've been around politicians and, you know, you've worked at the Federal Reserve. I mean, what is the likelihood that we'll fix this before we get into an actual crisis? In other words, get something done before it becomes full-blown front page crises and that's all we can talk about.
So I'm very hopeful on the coverage front that something will be done. We have these, nothing's been done at the federal level, and we have these states taking up these initiatives to cover the uncovered. So Oregon, California, Illinois, and several other states are putting, Oregon is up and running, are putting in place systems where employers without a plan have to put their employees' money into an IRA. The employee can opt out if he wants, but this is a way to get people in the habit of saving. But it's a crazy way of doing things to have 50 different retirement systems throughout the United States. So I'm hoping that someone is going to look at the absurdity of that and pass some national legislation that would provide for the uncovered. And I think that on the 401k things, the changes are not that enormous to make it work as well as it can. In terms of Social Security, I don't know. That always seems to, we need to go right up to the brink before anything actually gets done.
That's unfortunate. Well, let's keep our fingers crossed with people like yourself writing this book. And if you're planning for retirement, I recommend you pick up a copy of the book, because it deals with a lot of issues that this country faces, not just yourself, when it comes to retirement. Alicia, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. Great, great book. Easy read, short, punchy, straight to the point, highly readable. Thank you so much for writing it.
No, thank you, Jim. Nice to talk to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You know, I highly recommend this book. It is a short read. It's not real long. It's not one of those books that's going to get you into so many weeds, deep in the weeds, you don't understand it. It's not filled with jargon you're not going to understand. But it really highlights a lot of the issues that we cover here on the program, including our latest series on how to plan about retirement. It's not just a number. It's about you, and it involves so many more things. You know, human capital, social capital, different risks that you face. And she goes a long way about addressing some of this nation's biggest needs. not just Social Security, but also when it comes to medical care and even the type of pension plans that are used at the employer level. I'm Jim Poplava. Thanks for listening.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.